This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Julian Morrow. Welcome to the Roundtable. Well, what a year it's been, 2019. I know we say that every year, but every year it's true. 2019 brought the Banking Royal Commission report at the start of the year and maybe had Westpac thinking it would get through the year relatively unscathed. Cardinal George Pell was sentenced to 6 years jail in March and was the focus of some legal cliffhangers throughout the year. And then, of course, Australia and the world were rocked on the 15th of March by the Christchurch massacre perpetrated at mosques in New Zealand by an Australian live streaming his crimes and leaving 51 people dead. Scott Morrison won the unwinnable election in May and retrospectively declared his belief in miracles, at least publicly. I suspect Bill Shorten and the ALP can't wait to kiss 2019 goodbye. The coalition victory saw tax cuts pass, but failed to boost spending in the economy, which has remained fairly flat, despite a bit of kick coming back into the housing sector. And, of course, bookending the year with Royal Commissions, we still have the inquiry into aged care, which has unearthed horror stories. We are now dealing with a bushfire season, which started much earlier, any point in the 1990s, and smog rains down on the East Coast still. Well, joining us to dissect 2019 on the Roundtable today, John Daly, CEO of the Grattan Institute. Hello, John. Thanks for joining us.
A pleasure.
The Executive Director of the Ethics Centre is with me in the studio. Welcome, Simon Longstaff.
G'day, Jules.
And Samantha Maiden, journalist from The New Daily and author of the soon-to-be-released book Party Animals, The Secret History of a Labor Fiasco, coming soon in March 2020. Samantha, so many Labor fiascos to deal, to choose from.
It's a rich field.
I suspect there'll be sequels coming. But let's start off then, since we're talking about Labor fiascos, with the election victory of Scott Morrison. Unexpected, but definitely has shaped the political narrative of the country. Samantha, what's your take on the fallout from the coalition victory?
Well, I think that it has really, in the words of one person I spoke to for the book, ripped a scab off Labor, because it basically has forced the Labor Party to really have a really good, hard look at itself, its mission and its purpose. It's more than just an election loss. I mean, this was an election that they expected to win, and they have to really now, I think, look pretty deeply about what their mission is going forward. It's interesting. You don't want to overstate the parallels with the British election, but in both elections you saw, communities, working class communities that should be the core constituency and the base of the Labor Party, both in the UK and in Australia, turn against them. And so I think there's some interesting questions there about why their policies and their message and their leader is not resonating with the people that they actually, you know, were set up to help, and their core mission is to basically represent these people.
Simon Longstaff, one of the aspects of the Labor opposition leading up to the election was quite a lot of policy and not being the small target. From the perspectives of ethical leadership, is that a model that you would endorse? And do you think it has much prospects after Bill Shorten's faith?
Well, unfortunately, I do think it's another nail in the coffin of bold policy making, particularly by opposition, but probably by anyone. But I don't think we should take that as being an absolute situation. Look, the current context, I think a lot of people in Australia are feeling really uncertain about their future. They're nervous. And so anybody who comes with an idea which doesn't explicitly address where they're concerned, like will I have a job in the future due to automation and the application of robotics? Will I be able to pay for my healthcare? All of those things, that what you might call bread and butter issues, I think really are at the forefront of the minds of people. You've got to address those first and then have the policy extension around those core promises that give people that kind of confidence.
John Daly, the Grattan Institute, likes bold and clear policy initiatives. How do you see the political class's leadership panning out after the events of, the election of 2019? And what do you think it'll look like in 2020?
Well, obviously that election is going to dissuade oppositions in future from going with such a large target. I think the big question is whether they'll go with small targets or just smaller targets. Mm. We'd certainly hope it'll be smaller targets. I think the interesting question is for the government. You know, this is a government that in some ways has more authority than many governments for a very long time. Scott Morrison has a mandate internally because he won the unwinnable election. It has a Senate which is much easier to navigate than the Senates we've had for quite a long time as a number of electoral changes, electoral law changes have rolled through to it. And also, Scott Morrison went to the election not promising to not do things. So at least in theory, the number of things he could do is very large. Now, that said, he also went to that election with one of the thinnest platforms that a government has taken in quite some time. And certainly subsequently, it doesn't look as though this is a government that has a particularly thick agenda of things that it really wants to do.
Yes, Samantha Maiden, you did rather get
that. The mandate, though.
Yes, go on.
Sorry, I was just going to say, in terms of the mandate, the issue that you raised there, like, you are 100% correct that he has enormous authority within the Liberal Party because he won the unwinnable election. But, you know, let's not forget it was hardly by a landslide. So I think that because the election result was surprising, sometimes I think people overestimate or overstate in their own minds just how close that election was. Mm. Not to say that it wasn't a devastating defeat for the Labor Party, it was. But don't forget that, you know, the Labor Party actually won, you know, the popular vote in a large number of states in Australia.
Samantha, you get the impression that perhaps the coalition government wasn't fully expecting to be on that side of the House after the election. How do you think they've pulled together the task of government, perhaps a little bit in a little bit of a rushed way once they got back?
Well, Scott Morrison believed that he could get there because he believes in miracles, as we know, which is a beautiful thing. But I don't think most of his front bench did. And indeed, you know, a large number of them, you might recall, Julie Bishop and Christopher Pyne jumped ship. So, you know, I think people are retrofitting the result to think that the Liberal Party knew all along that they were going to win. You know, I think that he does have freedom in the sense that he's not locked in by a whole bunch of promises because he didn't have a whole bunch of policies. But I think the other interesting thing going forward that I've noticed a lot even yesterday, talking to some people, is that there is this sort of funk that, you know, some progressive people and Labor supporters are in, where they assume that the people that didn't vote for the Labor Party are stupid, uneducated, you know, made a mistake, were voting against their own interests. They have this whole view that, you know, that this was an election that was sort of stolen off them by Rupert Murdoch and Clive Palmer. And I think that while they remain in that mindset, you know, they're not going to win another election because, you know, the idea that voters are dumb and that they are stupid and that that's why they didn't vote for the Labor Party, you know, that is just not a winning platform to, you know, put forward a set of policies for the next election where the Labor Party can actually win.
Absolutely. All right, let's move on now to the banking Royal Commission. Obviously, huge attention on that and stories that really tapped into, I think, the resentment of financial institutions. John, do you think that the Royal Commission's led to real reform in the finance sector?
Well, it's certainly led to the regulators baring their teeth more often. Whether or not they're actually biting as often is less clear. It's led to bits and pieces, but I think the overwhelming impression is it hasn't led to massive real change in how the banking sector works. And interestingly, one of the central recommendations of the Royal Commission, which was around the way that mortgage brokers are regulated, is the one thing that the government elected not to do. Mm.
Simon Longstaff, obviously there's regulatory change, but from an ethical perspective, one of the problems seemed to be the internal culture within financial institutions. Do you get the sense that much has changed there? And how possible is it to achieve that sort of change in quick time?
You can't do it immediately. It takes 3 to 5 years to bring it about. I know that they're trying, but I think they're struggling to do it because I think also the overall expectations of the public have changed in line with the way that Hayne sort of caught the mood there when he talked about these fundamental principles and linked them back to community expectations. And I think some of them are just tired, you know, worn out after the pace of what the Royal Commission required, and they just haven't caught their breath yet. So, no, I don't think the change has taken place. I think there's going to be more problems for them, but at some point they're going to get on top of this. And they'll have to really look into the mirror in a very profound way and ask about the way they've structured their business, the kind of policies they've had in place. And I think we've got to allow them a bit of time to do that. It's something they should hasten with, but it's going to be a difficult thing to do given how deep some of the issues are within the culture of the organisations as a whole.
Sam Maiden, there are always Royal Commissions going on, but there do seem to be a lot at the moment, and they also seem to be a real driver of policy change. What do you think that says about the way national politics is going at the moment and the effectiveness of parties in reform?
Well, I suppose it says on some level that, you know, our politicians are cowards because, they have to commission these multi-million dollar royal commissions in some cases to get them to address issues that seem pretty clear. I mean, you know, in the case of the Banking Royal Commission, you had the Liberal Party telling us for a long time that, you know, that they knew about all these problems and they were working on them. And then when they were laid bare by the Royal Commission, they were incredibly shocking and disturbing to voters. And I think that transparency was really useful. But, you know, you still to this day have people, within the coalition saying that essentially they knew all about this and that they were doing things to fix it. Now, the Aged Care Royal Commission is another example. The allegations that have come out of that are incredibly disturbing. But is anyone really surprised? I mean, you know, the idea that, for example, we are drugging old people to make them more compliant in nursing homes. Is this a new thing? No. We have known about this for years. And so, you know, I think you are seeing a situation in some cases where I think transparency is great and people being able to tell their stories is really important. So there's a lot of good things that come out of these royal commissions. But it is disturbing, I think, that in some cases governments have failed to act on these things, which are actually quite well known until they have one.
Back to our earlier point about the election. I think politicians now are really good at winning elections. I'm not sure they're good at governing anymore.
Mm. Right.
And I think one of the issues there, and it's really arrived at a point in the last couple of days with the release of the Thodey review of the public service, is that I think there's an increasing belief amongst politicians that they should work out the policy and then public services should simply implement it. And the reality is that when politicians try and work out policy in their own little room and then just tell public servants what the answer is going to be, it doesn't seem to work out so well. You can look at NBN, you can look at Snowy 2.0, you can look at the rail loop in Melbourne, all things that were very consciously and deliberately done without the public service. And they do not look good, and they're increasingly looking bad in retrospect. Mm. And I think in the old days, there was a view that policy was something that is a technical problem. You need to think through all of the consequences. That's one of the things that public servants actually do very well. And that governments came up with policy, you know, having talked about it with the public service, obviously deciding what policy would be is very much a government prerogative, partly because you've got to think through the politics. But I think that there was also an understanding that thinking through all of the policy consequences, what's in fact going to happen, who's going to be affected, what are all the second order consequences, that was something that you really took significant public sector advice on. And I don't think that public sector capacity to give that advice is what it used to be.
And it's not sought. It'll be ministerial advisors. I do. I think that there's been a major structural change in the way we govern ourselves over the years, with the role of the minister's office as becoming a place for policy setting.
And politicisation of the public service?
Yeah, to a certain degree, or an ignoring of it to the extent that it doesn't accord. So I think the way our institutions are operating, that there's a problem there, whether you look in banking or the way that politics is working, all of them aren't quite firing as they're supposed to. And that feeds into that public disquiet that I mentioned before, where people are really quite worried about what's going to happen for their future. And if they see what I would call the ethical infrastructure of a society, an inability to operate as it ought to, failing, then they become more and more anxious. And that's where you start to get some of the difficult political outcomes as well.
And on the other hand, to loop back, you get this desire for royal commissions. When it all fails, it's kind of like, well, then let's go and have a royal commission because everything else has sort of fallen in a heap.
Samantha, let's sort of move on to the economy more broadly. Of course, ScoMo's miracle victory meant that tax cuts passed through the parliament. Did they have the desired effect of the government? And how do you think things look for the government managing the economy in 2020?
No is the short answer.
Good, right, clear.
The tax cuts were obviously aimed this first tranche at low income earners. And they were getting, I think, $1,080. It was a doubling of the low income tax offset. The advantage and the idea of giving low income people tax cuts is obviously quite sound, or in this case, it's actually a lump sum because they're more likely to spend it. But, you know, Shane Wright, I think, has written some very interesting things about this for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age about how this money doesn't seem to have really hit the shops. And so, you know, you have a lot of people. You know, coming back to what I think Simon was saying earlier in the program, where people have low secure jobs, they're worried about the future, they're anxious about their job security, you've got very low wage growth. You know, they might be, I assume that they're chucking that money on their credit card, for example, and paying off debt. But it has not had the stimulatory effect on the economy that, you know, might have been hoped. And so that's why you've seen the further calls to bring forward infrastructure spending. We, of course, have MyEFO, the Mid-Year Economic Fiscal Outlook, the budget update that's been the calls from the Labor Party to bring forward other tax cuts. But we're in this really interesting environment where essentially the normal levers that are being applied don't seem to be working in the normal way. So we've also had, you know, interest rate cuts, very low interest rates, and now we're having this whole debate about how the fact that doesn't seem to be working anymore, and, you know, there wouldn't be much point cutting it much more from there. What else can we do? So it's tricky.
John Daly, what economic issues do you think will or should be getting more attention after the way things have gone in 2020?
Well, I think the big underlying issue is that economic growth is pretty slow, and indeed economic growth per capita is negative. In other words, we effectively have less resources per person this year than we did last year. And the only reason that that hasn't hit the public consciousness is that overall economic growth is positive, but it's essentially being propped up by still quite high levels of migration. If you're really going to get serious about economic growth, then you start having to do the hard bits of economic reform. Some of them cost money. So, for example, we could increase the subsidies for childcare so that more women have an incentive to work more than 3 days a week if they've got children in childcare. Alternatively, or indeed in addition, you can look at regulatory reform, things that one way or another will free up markets. So, for example, you could look at the way that we regulate pharmacies. But all of these things tend to have losers, and those losers tend to yell very loud, and consequently governments are pretty reluctant to take on those kinds of policies that are really going to make a difference to economic growth in the long run, which is ultimately the only thing that's going to increase individual prosperity in the long run.
I don't think those things are going to have a huge effect. Yeah, I think if you look at the productivity problems in Australia, it's mostly related to underinvestment. And that's both a matter for the private sector, which is not investing at the level that you need, and also government. And I think the fixation with the surplus and a kind of naive household budget story that governments tell, as if governments are like households, and it's just not. It's a different beast altogether. Those things at some point are going to have to be addressed.
Sam Maiden, do you think that the coalition will actually get credit for getting back to a pretty thin surplus, or is that more a sort of political fixation than something that really scores votes with the people?
Well, they absolutely got credit with voters for having a forecast surplus. People forget that it wasn't quite a surplus. But it looked like one, and they had ads that said that they were back in black, AC/DC style. They absolutely got a lot of credit with voters, and I think that both the Labor Party pollsters and the Liberal Party pollsters got a bit of a bad name in that election, but both of them will tell you that pre-election budget on April the 2nd was a really big hard set for the Liberal Party. Telling voters that they had got the budget back in black was very important. It really negated the Labor Party's argument about cuts and you know, the idea that the budget was being cut again and that we were, you know, still in a budget deficit. So, you know, they got the credit. They won an election on it. You know, it was really important. And, you know, of course, there's all sorts of debates among economists about whether or not it's a good idea that we have a surplus right now and whether or not that is actually the best economic strategy. But in terms of a political strategy, I think it worked a treat.
The events in Christchurch in March were just absolutely horrific. They did dovetail, however, with some interesting policy, perhaps policy on the run, about social media, because, of course, all the events were streamed to some extent on Facebook and other social media outlets. There's been a lot of discussion about the role of social media platforms in terms of the move towards violent extremism in some parts. And the government's announced a new regulatory arm that the ACCC designed to deal with social media platforms. How do you see that working, Sam Maiden?
Well, badly, probably. I mean, look, Facebook is such a juggernaut, right? It's so massive. It makes so much money. The idea that it can't, you know, play some role in moderating this sort of conduct seems pretty hard to believe. I mean, you know, the technology and the science of what they do and how closely they understand what is going on within the ecosystem of Facebook, I think is really misunderstood, you know. I mean, they have enormous amounts of information and algorithms about what's going on in terms of Facebook. And so, you know, I think they can control that. Equally, you know, I think that one of the things that is good about the internet sometimes is that there's a degree of ungoverned airspace. Now, obviously, you don't want it to be ungoverned airspace when it comes to terrorists, but you know, I think, you know, you also kind of want to be able to track these people as well. So that's I suppose, there's a bit of a balancing act there because, you know, once you push people out of one sphere, then they go to another. Do they go to encrypted apps? Do they go to other things? You know, you do actually want to, I think, find some way of actually being able to track extremists and monitor them.
Simon Longstaff, I'm sure that the increasing dominance of social media in the way it sort of affects the way we communicate with each other and the sort of information we get, I'm sure that's something you've thought a lot about. Do you see much cause for hope, or what are the big challenges that need to be addressed here?
Well, first is that we can do something about it. So it's not as if this is impossible to deal with. For example, we published earlier this year a framework for how to embed ethics into the design of technology, not just wait till the horse is bolted and then try and close all the gates, but actually put in place a set of principles which can be executed by those who design it, that can be validated and assured, and then you could even have some kind of certification process. Because I think whether it's social media or other things in biotechnology, the power which is being unleashed now that has the effect upon individual lives and whole communities and nations is such that we ought to really be trying to bring some ethical restraint to the way they're used. So to get back to a Facebook, it could do something if it wanted to. Whether governments can make it or not is a different issue together. It's certainly, I think, going to require broader action than just Australia alone. And then there's the question about what the user's decision will be. And there's a kind of fickleness too about users. Facebook isn't in as such a dominant position as it was before. Younger people are moving to other platforms. So I think we should continue with the conversation about it. We should bring in nuanced tools which are really clear in their policy objectives as to what particular mischief we're trying to do. But I'd be engaging the Facebooks and the others who design the underlying technology and say, build it in at the beginning so that we don't have to have the further constraints put on it later on when things have gone terribly wrong.
John Daly, do you think that increased regulation of social media is becoming more likely and may happen?
Oh, I think it is now inevitable. I think Christchurch was a watershed moment. I think up until then there'd been a belief that the value of having this unfettered space over, you know, essentially was higher than any evil that it might do. I think Christchurch was a wake-up call, and internationally governments realised that simply leaving these things alone was not something that was going to lead to good ends. And I think it's a bit like the invention of the printing press. You know, it took us several decades to figure out, after the printing press had been invented, how do we regulate this in a way that we kind of balance all of the competing interests. I think we are now in a world in which we understand we have to do the same for social media.
Sounds like we can book that one in for the year in review in 2020, 2021, 2022, et cetera.
2031.
Yeah, absolutely. okay, look, we haven't got long left, but just finally, we saw mass student protests on the issue of climate this year. And obviously, there's been an intense debate about the bushfires and its connection with climate change, and even whether or not we can debate that. Sam Maiden, do you think that, I mean, the political class in Australia hasn't done a great job of engaging with climate policy in 2019, 2018, 2017. Much prospects of change on that front in 2020?
I wouldn't have thought so. I mean, not with Scott Morrison, you know, in government. I mean, they've made it pretty clear that, you know, what their position is, which is, you know, he believes in the science of climate change, but he believes that, you know, Australia's ability to actually affect any sort of outcome in and of itself is limited. And, you know, it's a reasonable position. But, I mean, if they're not going to lead some sort of international effort, I think that you're going to continue to have a real polarisation and a real divide between people that want stronger action, particularly, you know, in the wake of the bushfires and so on. You know, it's going to continue to be an issue.
John Daly, the business community and, you know, it seems that really the political class is lagging behind the rest of society here. Do you think... what do you think it'll take to change the sort of the mess that Australia's got itself in on these issues?
Well, I think two things are changing. One is we started the year with Tasmania burning and we're ending the year with New South Wales burning. And whether or not there is a strictly logical connection between that and action on climate change, I don't think matters, because I think in the popular mood it does. The second thing that's changing is that all states and territories now have a zero carbon emissions target for 2050. And there is an awful lot that states and territories can do, either individually or in cooperation, to really take serious action on climate change. And I think you can already see states moving in reaction to that. And indeed, they could do potentially as much as the Commonwealth government could do. It's obviously going to be more complicated, but I think we are likely to see a significant increase in state and potentially local council, but it's state governments that will make a real difference in terms of reducing emissions over the next couple of years.
In the 1970s, Australia unilaterally slashed its tariffs. It did it even though it couldn't affect the rest of the world. It did it because it was the right thing to do for this country. There were jobs affected, and that had to be managed in the same way that it would be some kind of just and orderly transition around climate. I just think it was all then about political leadership, making the case. And it's to do with Will, and I think it's tragic that you've got young people having to come out of school.
Because there really is a generational sort of
look,
divide
the fact
here,
that they
there?
Feel they have to do it because no one else is actually making the case within the political leadership of the country. That's both inspiring that they feel that they can do it and tragic that they feel that it's necessary.
Just quick final question to everyone. What was your personal highlight for 2019? We've only got a few seconds, but Sam, yours?
Oh, I struggled to find one. I'm such an optimistic person. Look, I think that it was great that, you know, some of the stuff that came out of the Royal Commissions, even though very confronting, I think it was good that those people got a chance to have their voices heard and their stories told.
Simon?
Young people standing up and speaking what they care about.
Right. And John Daly, your personal highlight to finish off our roundtable for 2019.
So my personal highlight was the passage by Parliament of a relatively obscure bill that changes your superannuation and how we force people into insurance. And it sounds small, but that is the kind of detailed stuff that good government is made of.
And that's all we have time for. Thank you to John Daly, CEO at the Grattan Institute, Simon Longstaff, Executive Director at the Ethics Centre, and Samantha Maiden, Political Editor at the New Daily. And that's our last live show for the year. From next week, Hugh Rimmington will be back to bring you the best of the roundtable from 2019. I'm Julian Morrow. Thanks for your company.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.